Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann, sharing stories of our food. Hello, folks. Welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann, sharing stories of our food, our planet, and those fighting for it. For 30 years, the Wildlife Habitat Council has been promoting and certifying habitat conservation and management on working lands through partnership and education. As the only international conservation NGO focused exclusively on the private sector, WHC provides framework and for voluntary conservation action on a wide variety of corporate lands. Wildlife Habitat Council corporate members represent multinational corporations seeking to support sustainable ecosystems and the community that support them. These efforts have resulted in more than 1,000 certified programs across 48 states, Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, and 29 countries. For today's show, we welcome a guest taking an increasingly impactful approach towards driving environmental change. For episode 96 of Sourcing Matters, we welcome Margaret O'Gorman, the president of the Wildlife Habitat Council. Margaret, welcome.
Aaron, thank you very much for inviting me to chat to you today.
Well, I do appreciate it. I know you've had a busy schedule, so if we get to too much, if I tighten the screws too much, you can let me know and we can tone it back during this tenuous time.
That's fine.
Very good. All right, look, first question I have for you, Margaret, is I've come to understand that since the inception of your organization, as we mentioned 30 years ago, that only 10 to 15% of the world's land surface has been protected. Your website clearly explains the importance of engaging private lands as an essential opportunity for restoring and protecting biodiversity moving forward. So what role does the Wildlife Habitat Council, or the WHC, have in instigating these practices?
Sure. It's a great place to start. And really what it comes down to for us is our mantra is every act of conservation matters. And we use that as a way to explain and to frame the fact that while only 15% of the world's lands are protected, we need 30% of the world's lands to be positive for nature to secure biodiversity going forward. So when we look at the difference between what's protected and what's needed, we see that the private sector is a very important player in this goal. So we work with companies to try to get them to think about their lands as a source of biodiversity and as a place that can be managed for nature, not just managed for operations.
Okay, so break it down for me, if you would. On the operational side, you're saying corporations. These corporations don't necessarily own the land, but they own goods and resources coming off of this, or how does it work?
So many times they own the land. If we look across the supply chain from the extractive industries, and if we think about mining, think about building materials, these are very important lands that can be reclaimed and restored for nature. In a very traditional sense, there have been approaches, usually driven by regulators, to bring the lands back to pre-extraction state, which is usually an agricultural state or not a very biodiversity-friendly state. So when companies can think about, instead of just bringing it back, you know, leveling a pit or bringing it back to some sort of less than wild nature, when they can actually bring nature back in, they can have a very outstanding impact on the lands that they own, on the remediation and on the reclamation of those lands. Then as we look into industry sectors like the utility sector, where large amounts of lands are being used for the infrastructure for the electricity that heats and lights our homes, those lands sometimes are owned by the companies, sometimes are leased or managed in other ways. There could be state lands, they could be federal lands, but how to encourage a company to manage those lands in a way that, again, encourages nature and enables nature to thrive, but while also making sure that the grid is as resilient as possible so it can continue to do what it needs to do. And we move then into just ordinary corporate lands like buffer lands around power stations, around factories, which can be quite substantial and can actually create really great parts of intersection for species movement, because habitat fragmentation is one of the most one of the largest threats to biodiversity at the moment. So it's really looking at everything that a company has right across the supply chain, from the extractives right through to even landfills at the end of the supply chain, that can have a benefit to nature, and thinking about it in that way.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You see these different, maybe anecdotal stories of people putting overpasses for wildlife to go over highways. Or we talk about corporations, as you said, making these buffer areas around some of their service lands. And it's fascinating because we're talking about biodiversity and as you had mentioned, migratory patterns of large terrestrial animals also impact diverse biodiversity, from insects to soil health to regenerative best practice. So it really does infuse or incur a much broader swath of understanding and the potential to engage that 30% protected. Is that the overall goal?
Yeah, I mean, the overall goal, there's a lot of focus given to biodiversity hotspots, and rightly so. There's a lot of money being spent in areas of high biodiversity value by national and subnational governments. But when we look at just biodiversity overall across the planet, so we think about everything from the rare and imperiled species right through to the most common species, and as you just said, right into soil health and things like that, we see that every act that people can do is a necessary act. So when we look at North America and the kind of species trends are not as dire as they are, say, in the equatorial regions, but still we are seeing common species becoming a lot less common due to habitat fragmentation, due to development, and due to land use practices that are detrimental to biodiversity. So it's basically looking at it all really as opportunity and thinking about it in a different way. There has been such a tendency for humanity to step outside of the system and basically alter the system for its own uses. But if we actually allow ourselves back into that system and manage with nature in mind, we will have better outcomes.
Maybe that comes full circle or full bear when we look at the rainforest, right? Where we're cutting down the rainforest to grow palm trees for our own agricultural resources or to raise animals on, not realizing that we're effectively cutting off our nose to spite our face here, looking at that. That is the impact of a reductionist approach is having huge problems on the global situation for 7 billion plus people across the world.
Yes. Yeah, and there's been many studies to show that it's not necessary, that there are other ways of approaching farming with nature, growing food with nature, and basically, you know, having our healthy society with nature. But the traditional approaches have not been nature-based. They've really been anti-nature in many, many ways.
So a few months ago, Larry Fink, CEO of the world's largest asset management firm, BlackRock, made a bold statement to his clients and really the world. He explained as an asset manager, BlackRock invests on behalf of others. And I'm writing you, as he said in a statement, as an advisor, a fiduciary to these clients. The money we manage is not our own. It belongs to the people in dozens of countries trying to finance long-term goals. And we're trying to have deep responsibilities for these institutions and individuals who are shareholders in our company and thousands of others to promote long-term value. He went on to explain and really started breaking down the idea of stakeholder value versus shareholder value. And it seems we're witnessing a bit of a sea change from the corporate side of things, maybe an awakening to a modern consumer or a modern investor, that there's deeper appreciation for this idea of a stakeholder value creation versus a shareholder value creation. So I was wondering if you could share with our audience a bit more about that. Could you explain the difference between the both, and what type of a declaration that Larry Fink made here? Is it a good sign of other things to come?
Yes, I think it's an interesting statement, and certainly his letter this year, and I think he had a precursor in 2019, which said the same thing, but not as forcefully. And what he's trying to do, and there's a group called the Roundtable, the Business Roundtable, that also made very similar statements in the middle of 2019, talking about what the purpose of a corporation should be. And it's really interesting because back in the 1930s, there was one of the first books on corporate social responsibility was written by H.R. Bowen, and he posited that a company had a social responsibility, and it was very much based on a Protestant stewardship ethic at the time, which is kind of an interesting take on it, but it was his times, and that's what he was proposing in the 1930s. But then, of course, Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, stated famously that the only responsibility of a company was to its shareholders. And that view has held a lot for a long time, for many, many decades. So when we see the Larry Finks of this world and the Business Roundtable and others talking about moving beyond that shareholder, pure shareholder, bottom-line-driven value, we really see what is, to me, a result of, yes, more informed consumers, but also a very, very serious challenge that companies are facing for recruiting the workplace of the future, trying to present themselves as good citizens as well as successful businesses for an incoming workforce that is viewing the corporate world in a completely different way. So over the 30 years of Wildlife Habitat Council, we have seen an evolution in how companies represent themselves as citizens in their communities. So 30 years ago, it was, you know, there's an opportunity to do something. Let's just, you know, plant a garden out the back. Or we did something really bad and we need to clean it up, so let's figure out how we do that. So today, the companies are really thinking in advanced ways of how to integrate nature-based programming or biodiversity into their strategic plans for employee engagement or for social license to operate, which is becoming very important. So you're really seeing companies think about the different ways in which they can leverage their citizenship activities to both protect and enhance their brands, protect and enhance their bottom lines, but also protect and enhance their workforce recruitment activities for future health and future stability of the company.
Yeah, workforce, no doubt, buyers, no doubt. And what's fascinating, we start looking at the transition of wealth, the individuals, the millennials that are going to be receiving up to $40 trillion of inherited wealth in the next 10 years. It's also probably good business to have a more value-based approach to it that you incorporate, sure, return on investment being financial, but being much deeper than that, being working with that namesake and the organization as a place to hang your hat, I guess. And fascinating to hear it from an organization like BlackRock or from Goldman Sachs or other players in this, you know, and so much is driven from the financial markets. So much is, if we really are going to instigate change, maybe the government side is going to be a little more reactionary, and we're going to lead from financiers. So have you seen it being a trend? Is are they the anomaly there? And is the stakeholder roundtable or this business group roundtable really the progressives, or are they, you know, the pioneers that everyone will follow?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question because, you know, what is the smoke and mirrors and what is actually happening here is, I think, going to be key for the future. So when BlackRock talks about it and the Business Roundtable talks about business with purpose, but we also see at the World Economic Forum in Davos this year, the Global Risks Report that the World Economic Forum publishes every year, for the first time this year, had nature-based risks as the top five risks in terms of likelihood and impact. And biodiversity was one of those. And if you look back at the evolution of biodiversity as a risk in the global risks report, you can see that it has rapidly risen from a probable risk to a highly likely and impactful risk. And that's another driver, I think, for these companies. So when you look at the companies who are kind of really taking it on board, it tends to be companies that maybe people don't think about and don't read about in the press all the time. So if you look at the extractives in terms of the mining companies and the building material companies, they've been out ahead, and I'm talking about biodiversity here, really. They've been out ahead in terms of their biodiversity engagement much earlier than some other companies because they've had to be, because they've had a direct impact. So when they've had decades of engagement with this issue, they're now more comfortable with this issue, and they're now designing better programs with this issue. But as you move through the supply chain, the further you get from the site of extraction, the further distance there is from engagement with biodiversity. And it's really interesting, like when you look in the tech companies, they say, we don't have a material impact on biodiversity. We're not doing anything. They may have beautiful forested campuses, but their service centers or their server farms and things like this are just not managed with nature in mind. So it's a really fascinating kind of spectrum across the industry sectors of how they're dealing with, certainly with the nature-based aspect of things. And nature, when it comes to corporate citizenship, nature is always a lagging indicator because most companies will start with a human-based activity first. And when you talk about supply chain transparency and supply chain greening or supply chain efforts, it starts with labor practices, it starts with people, and then eventually companies will come to nature. So the most evolutions we see is that the companies feel that they've addressed some of the other issues first and come to nature last, which that's just the nature of how companies look at their stakeholders and what's important to them.
Right. It's a bit of hiding behind the cloak of being downstream here. So that's fascinating. Maybe they gravitate more towards the social welfare side of things. And, I think there are other NGOs I know that are trying to integrate the transparency, traceability, the integrity of supply chain. So you do have a feel for who's producing it, what the supply chain's involved, specifically in the food side of things.
Yeah.
But what I found interesting for what you guys are doing with Wildlife Habitat Council is, as I had mentioned in an initial conversation a few weeks ago, I came out from the angle of the MSI, the Multi-Stakeholder Initiative. So my previous work was in there, and which is effectively partnerships where all types of diverse but vested stakeholders find common language to harmonize interests. And these well-orchestrated initiatives, they congeal NGOs, for-profits, government agencies, investors, influencers, the whole gamut, to work together, to move mountains effectively. And what I learned from what you guys are doing, I found very interesting. Maybe this is a point of clarity, or maybe it's something where you could jump off of this. You have a certification approach on the nonprofit side, but what I found interesting and probably an opportunity for a lot of these organizations on that multi-stakeholder initiative side is you also offer capacity building abilities via consulting. Mm-hmm. So you have a very creative approach of integrating both sides of it to not just let them talk about, yes, this is what we need to do and make broad declarations of, here's what's going to happen, but you actually give them the mechanisms to integrate that into their systems, into their supply chains. Mm-hmm. So could you explain to our audience a bit more of your business model and how it works, doing more great good while keeping the lights on and you still having access to resources that you can get some top talent for yourself?
Sure, yeah. Keeping the lights on, that's going to be an interesting challenge in the next few months,
I think.
You're right. Our signature offering, which we have offered for 30 years, has been a certification program. And that is really a recognition of the work that is being done on the ground. So we recognize programs that have been implemented. We don't recognize plans or wishes or ambitions or anything like that. But when the companies are actually implementing a program, a conservation program, they can seek certification for their efforts through our voluntary sustainability standard, which is conservation certification. And when we built that, it is voluntary, so which means that we are all carrots, we have no sticks. So when we realized that we're all carrots and no sticks, well, what we want to do is to help companies build the strongest possible programs so that when they're getting recognized, the recognition is meaningful and the recognition is actually driving change. So when we recognize the companies, we're recognizing them for the conservation context of their work. We're recognizing them for the community engagement aspect of their work and for how much the company is supporting the effort. So unlike traditional conservation projects that are recognized through biodiversity metrics that are very complicated and very costly, we're really focused on the intent and the implementation, less so than the outcome, because outcome is very, very hard in biodiversity in terms of accountability. But backing up from that, what we do is, you're right, it's the consulting services that we offer helps companies build programs that are suitable for their own specific business needs, are designed to meet those specific business cultures, and are built so that they are resistant to as many of the winds of business change that blow through companies on a cyclical basis. And so what I mean by that is, you know, you can easily say what the conservation action can be. You're on a monarch migratory corridor, you should be doing milkweed, you should be doing a pollinator garden. You're in the arid southwest, and you have a lot of property. You could be planting it for agave, for pollinating bats. You know, it's very easy to pinpoint the actual conservation action, but what's much more challenging is to think it through so that it becomes integrated into a company's strategy, so that the action at the site becomes meaningful locally, but also valuable at a global level when the company starts to report into their various corporate social responsibility and ESG ratings reportings, so that it means something to the C-suite as much as it means to the factory floor.
A bit of a systems-based approach, a systems-based benefit out of it, I would say.
Well, that's exactly right, because we see that a lot of corporate investment in conservation has traditionally been in an arm's-length philanthropic way. And when things like the stock exchange crashes happen, when economic fluctuations occur, those philanthropic investments are the first things to be cut. But if the biodiversity action is integrated into a strategy that is being reported into an ESG rating system, it lasts longer. It has a higher chance of surviving the economic cycles that hit companies on a very, very regular basis.
So I saw that you released a book in February, the book Strategic Corporate Conservation Planning, a Guide for Meaningful Engagement, includes case studies about some of the members, including Toyota and Boeing and Waste Management, American Electric Power, and others, all of whom have been successful conservation certification projects with WHC. Projects, from my understanding, range from simple pollinator gardens, as you had mentioned, to restoring salmon populations in the Boeing site in Seattle. Mm-hmm. There's a chapter about climate change, obviously, that are tied to that and much more. So it seems that you're capturing a bit of a zeitgeist here where patrons and supporters are reformulating expectations of brand and companies and providing their services and their goods. So I know it's only been a month, but how has your book been received by the industry and by your peers?
I hope it's being received well. Nobody has reviewed it on Amazon yet, but I launched it to a very friendly audience at our conference. These are the people who work with us, who understand and get it. And out in the larger world, the response that I have been getting has been, oh, I never thought of it that way. And I think that's kind of the response that I want, because I feel like the conservation community misses a little bit of opportunity by viewing companies either as a bottomless bank account or as an enemy. And instead of doing that, I feel that, you know, and this is the reason that I wrote the book, was to encourage other conservation groups who all have industrial operations or business operations to talk to companies as how can we help work together and how can we have joint goals and how can we develop something that will have meaning for each other instead of, you know, give us money and we'll do a cleanup or I'm going to sue you because you did something bad. So it was really a way for me to get both the corporate world to think slightly differently of the environmental world and the environmental world to think about the corporate world as having opportunities for action. And that's very much, it has been, I never thought about that sort of response that I've had from people.
It sounds very insightful. I mean, it is a situation where we all have to have a seat at the table to move things along here, right? And I have spent much of my career dealing with the folks that, and on the side of the people that have often been the finger waggers that will let perfect wit get in the way of good or progress or advancement or shown progress. Mm-hmm. So are there any stories in the book that specifically point that out where you see incremental gains, which then lead to a much larger, you know, potential or capacity for bigger change down the line?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely, there's certainly stories about that in the book, and I'll tell you one in a minute, but, you know, you're right about the finger wagging and letting perfect be the enemy of progress in many ways, and there's an author, Christine Bader, she wrote this book called The Evolution of a Corporate Idealist about her work in human rights in BP, and she talks about how there's a spectrum of engagement across any advocacy community, from the finger waggers, basically, right through to people who are working inside the companies. And I think about it in the same way for the environmental community, where there's a need for everybody from, you know, from those who want to sit in trees to those who want to sit in boardrooms and everything in between. So we need all approaches. But there has been this sense that those who sit in boardrooms are sellouts, where those who are sitting in trees are like heroes. But I think we're all heroes when we're working in this movement. And one of the examples that, you know, of something small happening that has allowed a greater change is with respect to Bridgestone USA, Bridgestone, the big tire manufacturing company. And like most companies that have industry, they have legacy sites that were polluted under lax materials management in pre-EPA days. And they had this really interesting project in the state of Maryland, outside of in Woodlawn, it's called, where the remedy, so the decision for the cleanup that was mandated by EPA would have required the site to have been scraped of every last inch of topsoil, to have been capped with a concrete cap, and to have been fenced off in perpetuity from the community in which it sat. Hmm. Bridgestone, because of some insightful people working at the company at the time and working with some consultants and working with Wildlife Habitat Council, advanced a methodology of phytoremediation, basically allowing nature to clean up the organic compounds that were on the site. And the EPA at the time allowed the remedy to change, which was almost unheard of. So what came from this is the EPA said, you can go to phytoremediation, natural attenuation, and see does the cleanup work from there. So Bridgestone saved $8 million on a remediation project. But more importantly, the community got that site back. It is not fenced off. It is not capped. And it is now an amazingly biodiverse project with a forest, with wetlands, with pollinator gardens that the community uses on a regular basis. And that then allowed Bridgestone to have those conversations again and again with EPA. But it also then allowed Bridgestone to understand that bringing nature into its workplace was a really powerful thing to do, and it developed at the time, a really good core of leaders within Bridgestone to support nature-based activities across, not just in the remediation side, but actually in the manufacturing side.
Sounds like a brown field into a green field turning to blue sky. Good stuff. I like that.
Yeah,
we had a couple past heads of EPA on. We had Governor Christine Whitman and we had Gina McCarthy on. And I found it fascinating. It wasn't anywhere near the, you know, of course there's bad actors that are corporations on there, but these were leaders that wanted to work with corporations to find that happy medium. They were looking for those instances to express and to show that there is potential. Because I think the, you know, what ends up getting to the average consumer or the people that live in those communities is just usually the hyperbole of the negative comments on both sides of it. So having those types of good storytelling and then also the good results and then the ability to use that is a multi-stakeholder win. That's a good example of that.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So a bit more on your background. Margaret O'Gorman operates at the intersection of business and nature. As president of the Wildlife Habitat Council, she helps companies find value in natural resource conservation and mainstream biodiversity across operations. Prior to joining WHC, O'Gorman served as the executive director of the Conserve Wildlife Foundation of New Jersey, where she transformed a little-known statewide nonprofit into a well-respected and effective organization focused on rare and imperiled wildlife protection to recover the Garden State. She began her career in education, publishing, and developed an expertise in secondary university STEAM education. So if you would, please tell us a bit more about your background and what was the spark that drove you into leading this type of organization around environmentalism.
I don't know if it was a spark or just more of an opportunity. So as I said, as you said in my bio, I had been working in educational publishing. That was in the UK. And when I moved to the US, I could have stayed in publishing, but it would have required me to go to New York City, which is not a place I didn't want to go. And I got this fabulous opportunity to work at the time as a development director, a fundraiser for the Pinelands Preservation Alliance, which is a wonderful NGO in southern New Jersey that is in charge of 1.1 million acres of incredibly interesting, unique ecosystem in the south, in the southern half of the state. So most people have a vision of New Jersey as the opening credits of The Sopranos, all industry and smokestacks. And very few people know that the bottom half of the state is actually very, very natural and very undeveloped, thanks to this beautiful place. So I ended up working there as a director of development, and working there was a great way to learn about how government, industry, NGOs can come together to have positive outcomes for the environment. And then from there, I went on to lead Yes Conserve Wildlife Foundation in New Jersey, which is focused on the threatened and endangered species in New Jersey, which again is another surprise story about New Jersey that, you know, New Jersey is a very biodiverse state. It's got one of the top locations for birding in the world in Cape May County in New Jersey. It's got over 100 pairs of bald eagles living in the state right now, and it's really an amazing place to do biodiversity work because it's challenging but fascinating. And then when the opportunity came to jump to Wildlife Habitat Council, I took it because I really thought that the intersection of business and biodiversity was one that was unexplored. And I'm somebody who focuses, who likes the action-based. I like to see boots in the ground and shovels in the earth. And the pride that people take in turning broken places into natural areas. So it really kind of suited my personality in terms of the places that we work and the companies that we work with.
And do you, I'm guessing from the book that you have a bit of a Celtic background or Celtic background. Is it, did you grow up in Europe? And when
Yes.
did you come to the States?
Yes, I was born and educated in Ireland. Mm-hmm. My family is still there, and I came over here in 1999.
Do you see any parallels of, you know, now stateside, we've always had a an abundance of natural resource, never to worry about these things. And we've kind of grown into our house where we're now dealing with water issues and land issues, similar to what has happened in Europe. Do you have any parallels from your upbringing in Europe and connecting it to what's going to happen stateside?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. As you know, one of America's greatest resources is its biodiversity. And it's people, somebody said this to me one time, I don't know, people go to Europe to visit the cities and the churches and the built environment. But when people come to the U.S., they come to visit the national parks and the natural environments of this country. And it's really true that the way and the biodiversity of this country is so powerful. It's been also been managed, I have to say, incredibly well by the federal agencies that are responsible by it and by the state agencies that are responsible for it. So when I compare how, like, Ireland has got this beautiful green image, and it is a beautiful green country, but underneath that there are challenges for the management of biodiversity because it is a very intensively farmed country, and also it has raced through its development. So I think that Europe has a lot to learn from the U.S. in terms of how it manages its biodiversity and its nature, because I do think that we do a lot right here. The way we approach, we don't do it all right. There's some weaknesses, of course. There's no perfect solution. But I do think that the U.S. has a lot to be proud of in how it manages its biodiversity.
Fascinating. Good to hear.
Yeah.
For my last question, I wanted to make it a bit of a timely scenario here. So in a recent Fast Company article, writer Adele Peters asked kind of a provocative question here of, what would happen if the world reacted to climate change like it's reacted to the coronavirus? And this is both imminent dangers here, something that we, you know, with climate, something we can't kick the can down the road any longer. So both threats are real. Climate change is obviously impacting tens of millions already now, but it doesn't have the same pressing concern. So are we in a shrinking planet, on a shrinking planet, how do we balance something that would cause hysteria or reaction actions focused to the immediate or what's next versus a transformation in how we're living our lives? And do these, you know, would it, to play off this question that Adele asks here, can we really scare people into lasting change, and do we want to?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I wish I had the answer to that question, because I would also add to it, how can we get people to be as scared of the biodiversity crisis as they are about the climate crisis, and then about this current pandemic crisis? Because to me, the biodiversity crisis, it's as existential as the climate crisis, yet it's getting 8 times less coverage. So when we think about the climate crisis and we think about humanity being impacted and we think about cities being destroyed and we think about all of those impacts, but if we lose nature, we are in much more serious trouble. So if we lose our pollinators, we're in very serious trouble. If we lose our soil, there's something the international groups say, we have 60 years left of soil. If we use our soil, we're in serious trouble. So how can we get people to take that seriously as climate change, and they're not taking climate change as seriously as they should? So I don't know what the answer is, because you do not want people going around in a serious depression. But I do feel that this is one area where the corporate world is leading, but the government needs to step up much stronger than it has. And I feel very strongly that it's only through government regulation that we're going to make the move as quickly as we need to make, because the solutions are so dispersed. They need some sort of a national or international approach to kind of figuring them out. And I wish I had the answer to it, but I don't want to hammer people over the head with the biodiversity crisis, and just like we don't want to hammer people over the head with the climate crisis. So yeah. I wish I knew the answer, but I don't.
No, I get it. Yeah, and it might be our opportunity. I mean, really, when we look at it, then you're right. I think it's an imminent and existential threat that people realize that climate is something, and it's become, you know, an awakening. But I agree with your point, and maybe that is the conduit of change here, is that look, we can worry about the climate all we want, but the real solution here is to balance those planetary systems, which start with biodiversity from insects all the way up through those terrestrial animals and down to soil health and phytoplankton. Because if we can engage those, then that's what really would ultimately balance the environmental and climate issues.
Absolutely. I mean, any solution, any nature-based solution to climate should have a benefit for biodiversity. So the two are so intrinsically linked. And if we can just get back into the system instead of trying to manipulate the system from the outside, we would be a much better species on this planet. Right now, we're an invasive species, and we're not helping. So, you know, we really start to think. And when we look at the coronavirus and everything that has come from that, that was partly, you know, their talk about it was an animal wildlife to human transfer. And it was a wildlife to human transfer because of partly the black market in wildlife that has been illegally bringing species into China for decades now. And China has said they're putting a stop to it. But that was us manipulating the system. And if we hadn't done that, we wouldn't be in this situation today.
Agreed. Yeah. Well, I will thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. I learned a great deal. Is there a location that our listening audience, who probably all will have more time on their hands and more time to read things that help us in the next few months, where can they turn to get more or additional information on what you're up to at the Wildlife Habitat Council and your new book?
Sure. So, yes, thank you for allowing me to plug my new book, which was published by Island Press, one of the best nature publishers in the country. So, you know, you can buy the book online at Island Press website. And our website is wildlifehc.org. And there's a lot of information about all of the work that we do there.
Well, Margaret O'Gorman, thank you to speak with us and share the knowledge.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks.